Welcome back. Todd Zwillick with you today. Queen Elizabeth II turns 90 years old today, and her son, Prince Charles, paid tribute to her with a reading from Shakespeare's Henry VIII.
She shall be, to the happiness of England, an aged princess. Many days shall see her, and yet no day without a deed to crown it.
Now, for most of her long reign, the Queen has ruled, well, symbolically over the British Commonwealth. It's mostly ceremonial these days. But that wasn't always the case. Kings and queens used to rule the British Empire, and it was far from symbolic. Today, you can find vestiges of empire in England and all over the world, and sometimes controversy to go with it. This week, India politely asked Britain to return the Kohinoor diamond. It's one of the oldest and well-known jewels in the world. The 105-carat gemstone passed through the hands of Mughal and Persian and Afghan rulers until the British took it in 1849 by force, apparently. Today, it's in the Tower of London, where tourists come to see it by the millions attached to the crown jewels. Now, there have been demands for the jewel to be returned since India gained independence, but the response from Britain, well, unwavering. Here's British Prime Minister David Cameron on Indian television in 2010.
The Kohinoor diamond, are you ever going to return that?
That is a question I've never been asked before.
Well,
but I don't think what tends to happen with these questions is if you say yes to one, you suddenly find the British Museum would be emptied.
Well, that's fine for David Cameron, but for many Indians, the Kohinoor diamond is a painful reminder of colonialism and of a national artifact taken by force. Joining me now from London is Anita Anand. She's a broadcaster and co-author of a forthcoming book on the Kohinoor diamond. Anita, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me, Todd.
Well, there is a long and twisted history, as I said. How exactly did the British get their hands on it in the first place?
It's a story of friendship turned sour, or perhaps surreptitious muscle flexing in the shape of friendship. So let me take you back. There was a man called Ranjit Singh, the Lion of Punjab, he was called. If you watch Game of Thrones, you hear reference to the King of the North. He was the real deal. He had united a disparate north of India into this almighty Sikh kingdom. But when he died and the throne passed to his son, a little boy, at the age of five who came to the throne, things changed drastically. The British, who'd never been able to get a foothold in the north as long as the Lion was alive, suddenly saw a chance to inveigle their way in. So first they come as friends, they sign treaties of friendship, they then start building up troops around the border, they are agitating within the boy king's court. So by the time that he's eight, all hell is breaking loose in his kingdom. They've done deals with really significant members of his court, his general, his vizier, and they are telling these men that, look, when the time is right, you betray the king, and we will give you something for your troubles. In fact, what they were offering were little kingdoms in their own right. So war is fought. They start getting a foothold. They can't get rid of the Maharaja because this is such a strong kingdom that these are warrior men in the north. So they say, no, we're leaving your Maharaja as he is, but just, you know, we come as friends. We're going to be in Lahore and we're just going to help him out a bit. And slowly but surely, they remove anybody from the Maharaja who can advise him. They take his mother, who is his greatest support, screaming from his side, and they lock her in a tower. And so in the end, you just have this really rather terrified little boy who is told that, look, if you want us to guarantee your safety, you're going to have to sign over the kingdom to us. And that's what he does. He's 10 years old. He's surrounded by grown men who are telling him, you sign here. And that's exactly what he does. He signs over his kingdom, he signs over his future, and he signs over this extraordinary diamond, the size and heft of a hen's egg, the most precious jewel in the world.
And so in a way, this diamond, though it's precious, is really just a symbol of an entire kingdom that these British invaders took for their own.
It was such a potent symbol of power that it was the one thing that Duleep Singh, this boy king who later grows to become consumed by the loss of it. It is the thing that he regrets the most. And, you know, the Indians didn't always have it. Ranjit Singh himself got the gem from a man called Shah Shuja. And you can trace it. I mean, I'm co-authoring this book, and it's a really kind of neat way of doing it, because the latter part of its history is my expertise, and the former part is a man called William Dalrymple, who has studied ancient Persian texts and goes right back to the Mughal period. So this is your original blood diamond, if you like. People have fought and died to get their hands on it. And I'll tell you for why. It's not just because of its symbolism, it was also because of its value. I mean, let's just put the bucks on the table. How much was it worth? Well, one of the sayings from a woman called Wafa Begum, who was the consort of one of the kings who had it previously, said, if you were to throw a rock high into the air, as high as you can, and to the left and to the right, all the space contained within, if you were to fill it with all the jewels and diamonds in the world, that would be the value of the Kohinoor. It represented wealth, it represented power, but it also represented India in many ways.
So let's talk about the time since 1850. Have there been concerted efforts from India, especially since independence in 1949, to get the Kohinoor back?
There have been efforts not only from India. I mean, there was a petition actually from a man who was serving as Indian High Commissioner in London at the time, who made active approaches to the British government saying, you know, you really need to give this back because it was taken illegally. There are representations that have been made from Pakistan. There's one that currently a petition has been accepted in the Pakistani courts saying this was a jewel of Lahore. Lahore now lies in Pakistan. You give it back to us. The Iranians would like it back. I think in the year 2000, the Taliban said they wanted it back because it was an Afghan gem. Yes, between you and me and the enormous takeaway audience, I've had people coming to me since I've written a book about the Dilip Singh family saying, you know, we are actually illegitimate children of his children. So maybe we have claims to this diamond as well.
There is a long list of foreign treasures in England, I'm sorry to say, that Britain has had to justify keeping. All products of empire, the Elgin marbles from the Parthenon, countless Egyptian antiquities from Giza and the Valley of the Kings and Karnak in Egypt, and now the Kohinoor diamond, and that only scratches the surface. Does there come a point where it's hard to justify keeping all of these things in London when the empire is gone?
You know, you have that brilliant satirist that we've lent to you. We'd like him back at some point, John Oliver, who said that, you know, the British Museum is now officially a crime scene. you make a very good point. These are the spoils of empire, no doubt about it.
Anita Anand is co-author of the forthcoming book on the Kohinoor Diamond.